Welcome back. Top of the second hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast, this Thursday, July 30th, 2020. And we're almost, we're speeding along through summer 2020. And in this dystopic maze, and, you know, again, I think that a lot of people are suffering from PTSD, trying to find terra firma beneath their feet. And as far as that's concerned, I think, you know, obviously psychologically, metaphorically speaking, trying to find solid ground. This is a moment, you know, again, I think this is a pivotal moment in so many ways. I think in many ways, God is saying, do you really want this? One of those ways is what I have tried to speak to that I think is a unique piece in the puzzle that I don't hear anyone else addressing. So I try to speak to the unique pieces that I see and also amplify voices like Candace and Dinesh that I think did a good job in that interview. We played some of that. We'll play more of it here in a little bit. But the piece of, again, you know, John Adams in his letter, February of 1818, positing the question, you know, he asked this question more than once, particularly in that letter to Hezekiah Niles, February 13, 1818. What do we mean by the American Revolution? Everyone thinks the American War. That's what he said. Do we mean the American War? He asked rhetorically, and he answered the question. The revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people, a change in their religious sentiments of their duties and obligations. And then he talked about how when the colonists believed that the king and all in authority under him were working in the best interests, governing in the best interests of the, you know, in justice and mercy, according to the laws and constitution, as Adams put it, in the best interests of colonists, they were, you know, they thought themselves bound to pray for the king, queen, and all the royal family and all in authority under them, as Adams put it. But when they saw those powers renouncing all the principles of authority and bent upon the destruction of all the securities of their lives, liberties, and properties, they thought it their duty to pray for the Continental Congress and all the 13 state congresses, etc. And so I think we're at a similar pivotal moment where we can reflect on what we're seeing and say, is this true? Does this make sense? And I think that's part of the PTSD that people are experiencing. There's something gnawing away people who don't traffic in this, you know, information that is not, you know, that's off of the mainstream highway, that's not in the bumper bowling lane, so to speak, and that is counter to the establishment narrative. Even those people are, you can see that there's just, it just doesn't make sense. But you know what, I gotta go along to get along. I gotta do my part. I have to believe. And then there is the advanced form of that, which is Stockholm syndrome, where you have to believe that your kidnapper is right because that's your only psychological outlet for survival, is what's believed somewhere in the back of one's mind. So speaking of questioning these things, when I say that the World Health Organization is patently anti-American in its founding and its roots, and it is, by the way, you know, founded in 1948 as part of the, as a specialized agency of the United Nations with a broad mandate to act as a coordinating authority on international health issues. You can see now with the overwhelming influence of Big Pharma and Bill Gates in particular, and the Gates Foundation and Gavi put together contribute more to the World Health Organization than any other organization. So you could say, I would say by proxy, Bill Gates is the hand that feeds the World Health Organization. And again, speaking of that, I think of Mark Twain's Cornpone Opinions. Show me where a man gets his corn pone, and I'll tell you what his pinions is. So Bill Gates is unelected. Bill Gates is not a doctor. Bill Gates is not a virologist, epidemiologist, any of those kinds of things. Bill Gates is, in fact, a college dropout, an unelected college dropout, who is the most influential figure financially in the World Health Organization. Does that sound American to anyone? And you get into the roots of the World Health Organization, like I said, back to the United Nations, back to the Rockefeller hijinks, and so on and so on. So me saying that the World Health Organization is patently anti-American in its founding and roots is not to be construed as me being a Trump apologist. Correlation does not equal causation. In this case, I'm simply stating an observable fact of history, not parroting sycophant talking points, however remotely related they may be alleged. Nor does it mean I don't want to stop a pandemic, which is an absurd insinuation, frankly. Again, the most recent observable evidence being the clips we played yesterday, one of which, the Dr. Jeff Mitchell clip I cited today from America's Frontline Doctors Summit Session 2, and I repeatedly made reference to Dr. Mitchell's presentation and even his opening slide, which I read, and, you know, which read, and I quote, "The question, how can we end this pandemic?" So I ask, are Fauci, Gates, Redfield, Collins, Birx, Hogan, Newsom, Inslee, Cuomo, Whitmer, Northam, Bullock, or any of the other autocrats raising that question? Or are they simply trying to cling to their newfound drunken authoritarian power? And that is basically the modus operandi of the World Health Organization. It needs subjugation to validate its existence. All of these autocrats need subjugation to validate their existence. Socialism needs subjugation to validate its existence. So are these folks, you know, who is calling, is the establishment narrative to, you know, the question. That's what Dr. Mitchell's slide read. The opening slide read, the question, capital T, capital Q. The question, how can we end this pandemic? Who is asking that? Is, you know, Anderson Cooper? Is Don Lemon? Are these people asking, how can we end it? Legitimately, not with propaganda and spin and, you know, psychological operations. So, are autocrats raising that question, or are they simply clinging to their newfound drunken authoritarian power? Are they trying to return Americans to their own autonomy, or are they trying to further subjugate and enslave all? Do they need subjugation to validate their existence? That's what we're seeing. That's the issue. Not whether I'm a Trump apologist or whether I want to stop a pandemic. Obviously, I want to put an end to all of this nonsense immediately, because it is nonsense. It's autocrats trying to validate their existence and legitimacy, when in reality, they're illegitimate. And so that's why the propping up of all of this nonsense requires a constant reinforcement, a unilateral totalitarian propaganda campaign, as Hayek, you know, described in Chapter 11 of The Road to Serfdom. The Chapter 11 was titled The End of Truth. That's what we're seeing all around us. The truth is drowned out. Doctors met on the steps of the Supreme Court to tell America this is outrageous. What is happening goes against real science, which is redundant. As many, even folks I don't agree with ideologically, have noted, you know, Peter Thiel, for example, when you try to stick science on something, climate science, for example, It's dubious. It's a dubious distinction. You don't say physics science or astronomy science. No one makes those distinctions. So hopefully that makes sense and explains a little bit. And with that, let's get back to the interview. Dinesh D'Souza and Candace Owens. Fantastic interview, in my opinion. Go ahead, please.
Government that's also going to pay for citizens to not work and to do nothing. So it's tremendous. They want to grow government, but they want to make sure that you don't have these institutions that's going to protect the citizens. It's all so confusing. And you have to ask the question, what is the left after? What are they after? You know, you've got on the one hand, they say they spend years. We need to make sure that nobody in America has a gun. We want to unarm the citizens because if you're in an emergency, you can call 911. Now we're suddenly arrived at, we want to defund the police. And by the way, they're carrying signs where I live that say abolish the police, right? So which is it? You know, do you want us to be able to call 911 when there's an emergency, or do you want to abolish the police? Why does it seem like we're going all over the place and there's really no structure in terms of what they're actually after?
So I like to take a stab at saying what they want, what I think they're going for. A lot of conservatives have said over the years that socialism will never work because it's against human nature. But I think that the new socialism that they're pushing now is not against human nature. It actually appeals to a very low, unappealing side of human nature. So under coronavirus, for example, a lot of people have been sitting on their couch. And the left is saying to those people, hey, isn't that kind of nice? I mean, gee, do you really want to have to start dressing up again and shaving and going into work and punching a clock and listening to your boss rave on and on? Wouldn't it be cool if we gave you $2,000 a month and you just hung out on your couch perpetually? There's a little part of everybody that goes, why not? You know, really? Now, the leading socialists, the people who are pushing the system, are extremely cunning and ambitious. They are not sitting on their couch. In fact, they have indefatigable energy. The problem is that they don't have any of the skills that are good in entrepreneurial society. Take people like Bernie Sanders, Obama, Hillary. It's not that they are unindustrious. It's just that if you ask them to make an iPhone, they wouldn't know how to do it. If you ask them to figure out Amazon Prime, they would be clueless. They're useless figures in an entrepreneurial society, but they recognize that in a socialist society, they would be the ones in charge. They'd be driving the carriage. So when Elizabeth Warren says something like, you know, I want to turn over healthcare to the people, that's democratic socialism. The people will be in charge of healthcare. I say to myself, well, I'm part of the people. What say do I have in any public institution? The post office. Do I have any say in the way the post office is run or operated? No. Do you have any say in the way the DMV operates? No. Does the ordinary British guy have any say in the way the British National Health Service works? No. So when they say the people, who do they mean? They mean Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. She's going to run the health. She's going to tell you, sorry, Candace, you have this condition, but you're going to have to just wait. So ultimately, they've realized that socialism can work for them, not just in power, but also in money. I mean, look at the American socialists or the people leaning in that direction. They have all cashed in big time in politics. Mm-hmm. The Clintons went from zero to 200 million. The Bidens from zero to 100 million. Al Gore's worth $100 million. The Obamas are worth over $50 million. Think about that.
Right.
How do you make that kind of dough on a government salary? By the way, there's no politician in Scandinavia who has ever done that.
Right.
But in Venezuela, if you look at the Chavez family, the Maduro family, the Chavez family are billionaires. They're the richest family in Venezuela. So in Venezuela, as in America, socialism is big business.
Right. And, you know, I think another element of this is that people don't understand anything about their government. And we really are flying blind. And why I think, you know, the first way that we defeat this is that we have to do something about the education system. I mean, they're pulling out classes in civics. You can't learn about Western civilization, right? That's racist. You're not learning about civics. All you're learning about is exactly what you're talking about. Men, why men are bad if you're a woman. Why white people are bad if you're a black person or a white person. They now have classes where white people have to learn about their white guilt. And what we've really done is we replaced a solid education system with psychological conditioning, right? These kids come out of school, they hate the West, they think there's something fundamentally wrong and backwards about capitalism, about Western society. Yet, if you speak to any of those people that speak so negatively about America, they'd never want to go live anywhere in the East. Why do you want to live in the West? You know, why would you prefer your kids grow up here as opposed to growing up somewhere like Russia? And this is sort of the problem that we have, is that we're fundamentally teaching anti-Americanism. And I feel badly when I see these kids, like these, you know, 15-year-old Antifa thugs, right, running around, rioting, because they really know nothing. They know nothing.
Academia is the theory and Antifa is the practice. Mm. So if you think about it, what the left has done here with the George Floyd killing is they've taken the episode. Now, when that episode first occurred, everybody said, that's bad. Mm-hmm. That's wrong. And there was an opportunity to have a moment of national unity, which is we all agree on something and we can proceed to look at what happened and how to fix it. But the left realized, no, that's not what we want. We actually want an opportunity for racial division. So what we have to do is we take the George Floyd episode and attach it to a larger narrative. Now, the larger narrative is unhooked from George Floyd. It's things like, from the George Floyd episode, you think, okay, if we see a bad cop, the solution to a bad cop is obviously to have a good cop. So let's try to get more good cops. But that's not the left's approach. The left's approach is all cops are like that. Cops are chronically racist, even black cops. Because as you remember, in the Floyd case, there was a black cop, there was a an Asian cop. They're all racist. And why are they racist? Because they're part of a racist system. Mm-hmm. So America's racist. And not only is it racist now, but it's been racist not only since 1776, but since 1619. This is the New York Times' infamous 1619 project. So the demonization of America narrative is now put on top of the George Floyd killing. And the basic move is if you deny the narrative, you don't care about George Floyd. Mm-hmm. So this is what intimidates people on our side. It intimidates pastors. It intimidates Republican politicians. They feel they have to genuflect before this narrative or else they'll be accused of being racist.
That's right.
Now, this narrative has been concocted and manufactured by progressives over the past century. And they have been, in the past, they had to debate it. Now they don't debate it. They just drum it into young people. And these young people don't know the counter narrative. Mm-hmm. Now, our side is actually pretty good at putting the counter fact, saying things like, well, the majority of people killed by cops are actually white. Mm-hmm. But a fact doesn't dispute a narrative, because a narrative is actually an interpretation of a wide body of facts. And it's really important for our side to generate counter narratives that tell the other story of America that young people are not being subjected to. This is where our universities have completely broken down. Because if you really believe the narrative, let's say you really believe this country is racist to its core, it's built on oppression, its wealth has been generated by oppression, then throwing a Molotov cocktail into a police precinct is in fact logical. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to do whatever you can by any means necessary to take down this monster.
You know what? That's actually very interesting. And I wanted to talk about that. And I just want to bring up people that are watching this. If you don't recall this incident, a Molotov cocktail was thrown into a police car in New York City. And the two people were actually arrested that threw the Molotov cocktail. And both of them were recent graduates of Yale and Princeton University, NYU Law, Yale and Princeton University in their undergrad. And I mean, these were remarkable students, immigrants.
One was Asian Indian.
One was Asian Indian, which then I just couldn't wrap my head around this. They worked at a top-tier law school, a top-tier law firm, and I could not wrap my head around what would possess these people coming to this land doing phenomenally. You know, their peers were shocked that they were caught and throwing this into a police and ruining their entire lives. They're now on, you know, they're going to have to face up for attempted murder.
So this is the thing that, ironically, if those same people had gone to a community college or a working class university, they would not have felt that way. So it's not paradoxical or strange that they got this ideology in the Ivy League or in the top-ranked university, because the top-ranked universities are the most radical. That's where this ideology is the least contested. So it's actually, in a way, predictable and normal that we have trained many of our best students to be the most subversive, the most vehement in rejecting American principles. Now, for me as an immigrant, having come to America at the age of 17, when I got to college, It was very strange to me that people saw American history in terms of sort of three brief episodes. There was the founding, which is seen as sort of a racist act. Then there was a civil war, which is seen as a very partial and imperfect attempt to correct the founding. And then we jump forward to the civil rights movement. And that's pretty much American history.
Right.
That's it. And I said to myself, this is actually not what interests me at all. Because you're talking about the extension of American prosperity and American rights to previously excluded groups, but I'm interested in how that prosperity and those rights came about in the first place.
Right.
In other words, how does a country go from being a backward country, a third world country, America, in about 1810, to then becoming the richest country in the world in about 50 years? How is it the case that 60% of all the important inventions in the world have occurred in this country and no other? It almost makes other countries seem stupid.
Right.
So how did America become responsible not just for this or that invention, but the invention of invention? Who did those things? And I realized that even in the 80s, academia was dead silent on this question. And only later I realized that progressives have done a lot to cover up this question, because in order to focus on the distribution problem, they have to hide how the wealth is created in the first place.
And they also have to hide their own history. And I'm glad you brought up the fact that these are, you know, all of these bad ideas, they come from these top-tier universities. Every bad idea, postmodernism, came through Yale University. The idea of eugenicism, Yale University. Again, Madison Grant, who wrote The Passing of the Great Race, which was wildly popular during the Progressive Era. He was a Yale University graduate. Eugenics, that was you know, Harvard. People thought that there was something fundamentally wrong with the immigrants that were coming from Eastern Europe. And these universities never, ever, ever have to fess up for what they've done. They just continue to pollute and put out bad ideas, and there's never any accounting. And right now, the bad idea that they are obsessed with, that they are perpetuating right now, beyond the racial narrative, beyond the gender discrimination narrative, is socialism. I wish we had more time. I think every single person needs to go out and get this book, The United States of Socialism by Dinesh D'Souza. You need to understand everything about socialism so that you can actually teach people who know nothing and think that they're fighting for something that's going to be good. Dinesh, we wrap up every episode by allowing you to leave a 2-minute face message with the world. So you're going to say what you hope falls on their ears, tell them maybe something about your book. There's so much in there that we didn't get into. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
On your mark, get set, world, I give you Mr. Dinesh D'Souza.
So the left will defend socialism today by saying it's democratic socialism. They say that they're extending the same democracy that we have in the political sphere into the economic sphere. And the point I want to make is that capitalism or free markets are actually far more democratic than socialism, even democratic socialism. Now, why is that? Well, in politics, we vote every 2 years, maybe every 4 years, sometimes if it's not raining. So it's a very indirect form of democracy. And we don't decide things for ourselves. We vote for other people, representatives. They decide for us. Now, you are a citizen and you vote, but you're also a consumer. But as a consumer, you vote in the market every day. You vote constantly, regularly, and while it costs you nothing to vote in when you cast a ballot, you're voting with your hard-earned dollars in the market. And the point I want to make is, in that sense, free markets are far more accountable to popular will, popular consent, than anything in the political system. So we don't need to extend democracy from the political to the economic sphere. Why? Because we already have it. Capitalism is a form of social justice. Too often we defend capitalism by pointing merely to its efficiency, but we need also to defend its morality. That's the key argument I make in the United States of Socialism. And also, Candace, we have a movie coming later called Trump Card that takes this sort of backbone of the book, converts it into an emotional and inspiring narrative that's coming later.
All right, well, make sure you guys go get The United States of Socialism. Dinesh, thank you so much for coming on the show. I wish we had more time.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That's a wrap.
There you go. I thought it was, an outstanding interview. And again, to sort of bridge the gap, you know, I think there's socialism and there's COVID-19. And so how do you push towards socialism, a more overt form of socialism, from COVID-19? Well, I think Mencken put it best back in 1918 when he wrote, "Civilization, in fact, grows more and more maudlin and hysterical. Especially under democracy, it tends to degenerate into a mere combat of crazes. The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, most of them imaginary. And think about all the hobgoblins that we've faced this year, just this year alone. I mean, there's the COVID-19 ridiculous farce. It's a farce. The way that it's cooked up to be, it's a farce in that context, period. And, you know, what have we had? Murder hornets and bubonic squirrels and all kinds of crazy things just this year. And, of course, you know, now we have the natural disasters, and we know that for more than 100 years, the weather has been influenced, if not engineered. Certainly for decades, for generations now, there has been weather modification. I mean, for those who don't know, the look up Operation Popeye, for example, and you know, efforts of the United States government experimenting on the American people as far back as the 1940s, large areas of dense population to see, you know, what would happen. What happens if we spray them like bugs? And, you know, the efforts to influence troop movements in Vietnam, for example, using weather modification. So, you know, now, I mean, like Michio Kaku says, it's like bowling. We spin a hurricane up off the coast of Africa, and then it hits Florida in predictable fashion. It's like bowling, he says. So you have that, you have the fires and things. You know, there were torrential rains, and then suddenly everything's dry, and it's fire season throughout the Pacific Northwest. And it's probably going to be a record fire season in some way, as it has been every year for the last several years. So we're being menaced with an endless series of hobgoblins, most of them imaginary, as Mencken put it. So what does this lead to? Does it lead to people, you know, what is the tendency? What is the momentum? What is the trend? Is it toward autonomy, personal autonomy, and people acting like responsible adults? You know, like Edward Abbey said, grown men do not need leaders. Or is it this hopeless dependence and reliance upon something? And usually it's the something or the someone is the same something or someone that is responsible for the endless series of hobgoblins menacing society, which gets back to the folks, some of which I mentioned. What are they calling for? You know, Fauci, Gates, all these people, you know, every time they talk. And, you know, while society is waiting on a vaccine, it's our only hope. It's not my only hope. I can tell you it's my last hope. That's the last thing I would ever. No, thank you. With all due respect, absolutely not. So, you know, what is the tendency of all of this menacing and all of these edicts and rules and so forth? Is it toward personal autonomy, people acting like responsible adults, deciding for themselves what is best and how to comport themselves in a way that is not only right and good for themselves and their own lives and their families, but also for the folks around them, so that we can live in a cohesive environment? Or is it the opposite? You know, is it people behaving like children, depending on a mommy or a daddy to take care of them, keep them in line? Stick around, we'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extend your life with Extend. Extendivite really works. Here are some reviews from Amazon.com. Nikki, great product. Have to try it for a few months to see results. After taking Extendivite for about 6 months, I have noticed improvement on the numbness of my hands and wrists from carpal tunnel. I will continue to buy the product. Ken Peaks, 5 out of 5 stars. Works as advertised. This formula is very powerful. Be careful to follow directions. I am feeling much better. My heart rate and blood pressure has stabilized and my lower edema has reduced. Lower leg pain due to blood clots has disappeared. Thank you. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extend.
Is the Second Amendment your line in the sand? Is the United States Constitution important to you? Are you worried about gun confiscation? You need to join us for free at gunconfiscation.com. At gunconfiscation.com, you will meet like-minded patriots, get the latest Second Amendment news, and find anything you need to prepare for gun confiscation. Visit gunconfiscation.com today. That's gunconfiscation.com. Which side are you on?
Talk Right, the conservative app offered by TalkStream Live that caters exclusively to the conservative talk radio community. Here you'll see only talk shows and podcasts from the conservative right, all the big broadcast names and online digital shows in one place. Talk Right makes it easy to find all your favorite conservative talkers with all the upscale features you come to expect from TalkStream Live. Keep up with the fast-paced political world. Download Talk Right today from Google Play or the App Store.
Did you know that you can be tracked and traced when you're online? With identity theft and cybercrimes on the rise, your passwords, your identity, and even your physical location can be revealed to complete strangers. Would you like to surf the internet anonymously and not have to worry about these threats? Well, now you can by visiting patriotinternet.com. For about $2 per month, patriotinternet.com will conceal your IP address and your physical location, allowing you to browse the web, send emails, and instant message anonymously. Patriotinternet.com will bypass filters, block sites, and keyword blocking. You can also bypass logging by your router and your ISP. With PatriotInternet.com, there is no software to install and uses 128-bit encryption for your protection. When using wireless hotspots, PatriotInternet.com shields your information from identity thieves and is compatible with Windows, Mac, and Linux. Protect your identity and your freedom with anonymous internet access from PatriotInternet.com. Visit PatriotInternet.com today.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle humps, ready to race to you. These days are ours.
Happy days.
These days are ours. Share them with me. These days are ours.
Happy days.
These days are ours.
Welcome back. Before we go back to the phones here in a second, let me just say I thought the interview was outstanding. One of the most salient observations I thought Dinesh D'Souza made was this idea there toward the end when he's talking about, you know, the conflating of the George Floyd killing and the narrative. And if you how did he put it? If you, the way he put it, the demonization of the American narrative is now put on top of the George Floyd killing, and the basic move is if you deny the narrative, you don't care about George Floyd. And he said, so this is what intimidates people, It intimidates pastors, Republican politicians, and others who feel they have to genuflect before this narrative, or else they'll be accused of being racist. And the narrative has been concocted and manufactured by progressives, he says, over the last century. Anyway, so now they don't debate it, they just drum it into young people, and he says the young people don't know how to counter the narrative. And again, this gets to, ideological perspective and so forth, and values. You know, do you value the autonomy of the individual, or do you value and celebrate as supreme the herd, essentially? Is the herd more valuable than the individual? And it's sort of a, it's an oxymoron, because without the individual, you have no herd. So, and that was supposed to be, in my humble estimation, one of the big lessons of Western civilization. But one of the most salient observations Dinesh made after that was, he said, but a fact doesn't dispute a narrative, because a narrative is actually an interpretation of a wide body of facts. And it's really important for people to generate counter narratives to tell the other story of America. And folks have been trying to do that. Like I said, America's frontline doctors, you know, and the Second Opinion Project is a way to do that. But we have to also, I think, acknowledge that you can't beat the devil at his own game. So it's more than just counter-narrative. And, you know, we're in a difficult age right now where the truth is unpopular for a variety of reasons. And that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be told. And, I don't know, defended, or, you know, that it shouldn't be told in steadfast and resolute fashion, perhaps, is a one way to put it. To the phones, Richard in Washington, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yeah, the bumper music and what you've been talking about, I think, hit the nail on the head. Happy days were when we were irresponsible, youthful. Our parents would take care of us, and we didn't have to worry about anything like working or whatever. And that's what America was all about. Essentially, we wanted to get away from parents. We didn't want the king, or we didn't want the pope or a church or whatever. We wanted to be responsible. We wanted to be adults. Well, that's changed over time. We've lost that. We no longer want that responsibility. We want to be kids. We want somebody to take care of us. Like you said, we want to be part of the herd. We want to be socially acceptable. And that means a minimum of work for a maximum of pleasure. And I think that's where we are. But what I wanted to do was go back a little further. There's a book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess by Leonard Schlein. And here's one paragraph. Anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss was one of the very few scholars to challenge literacy's worth. This is a quote. There is one fact that can be established. The only phenomenon which always and in all parts of the world seems to be linked with the appearance of writing is the establishment of hierarchical societies consisting of masters and slaves, where one part of the population is made to work for the other part. Literacy has promoted the subjugation of women by men throughout all but the very recent history of the West. Misogyny and patriarchy raise and fall with the fortunes of the alphabetic written world. So basically that's it. As we become, quote-unquote, adults, we keep this childlike mentality. We try for the easy road. We try to restore happy days, as it were, of infancy. And you know, it's just not possible. You either have to be a tribal person and entirely dependent on yourself and the people around you working together, or you become part of the herd and you want social conformity to take over and essentially bring you all your pleasures without any work on your own. I think that's the bottom line as I look at it, and that's where we've fallen.
So with Google and Alphabet, I think, you know, the Alphabet, basically the goddess cornered the market on the Alphabet.
Well, the goddess was separate from the Alphabet. The Alphabet is essentially left-brained. the goddess is right-brained, and essentially seeing the bigger picture, the image and the totality of things, you see the little nitpicking things. Instead of seeing the forest, you see the pieces of bark on the tree, and that distracts you. That's why, quote-unquote, specialization has become so prominent now. You know, you got to look to this expert who's a specialist in, mm-hmm. in some form of life, and you've lost the fact that, you know, we're here to enjoy life as part of nature in the bigger picture. I think we've just fallen on times that, we've become so successful that we've lost why we became successful, as you pointed out, or as the piece that you added, these people forgot how America became the leader of the world, mm-hmm. And how they had all the inventions, et cetera, because mm-hmm. they just lost their way.
Yeah, as Dinesh was saying, and it's interesting, you know, the observation has been made. I think actually you're one of the people has said, you know, if you want to know about water, don't ask a fish. And so Dinesh is an immigrant to America telling us how America works.
Well, that's it. He came from a place where that, you know, things weren't given to you. I mean, you weren't in a state of childhood your whole life. You had to work basically being born until, you know, you achieve some success. And we've lost that. Essentially, we're given everything now. We get to go to school, you know, and have lunchtime and playtime and whatever. And then we go to college, and again, we play and party and whatever. And then we go out into the real world. And in today's society, the government kind of take, well, I lost my job. Well, I can get Social Security, or I can get unemployment or whatever. I mean, it's cradle to grave childhood is basically what's corrupting us.
Absolutely. And people have been dumbed down to a point that they don't realize, you know, when you say specialist, well, you know, these things are very sophisticated and blah, blah, blah. Well, go back and look at some of the inventions of guys like Ben Franklin, and I'm not sure that argument holds water.
Well, and the point you, the differentiation between the left and right brain, all these people that did these inventions, usually they came in a dream, or they came while they weren't focused. And you know, we've lost the difference between that marriage of right and left to the fact that we think we should all be literate now, we all should be specialists, we should all know things in the written word. And we've lost the connection with nature, and because
STEM
of that
schools.
Loss,
we've science, we've technology, just engineering, away. And math, right?
Exactly. STEM. We go to school to, quote-unquote, be brainwashed. That's it, to be left-brain trained, and we lose the bigger picture. We've lost tribal. And I've brought up before the SRS Rocco report about the energy thing, how much energy you put into something and how much energy you get back. When we were hunter-gatherers and tribal, you know, for every unit of energy we put in, we got 10 back. Now we're completely reversed. I mean, we have to put in 10 units of energy to get one back. You know, the whole childhood provision thing has just changed the whole dynamic of how we function.
The way I like to think of that is we're on the wrong side of the fulcrum, and I see that in many areas of life. And to further out of your point, I mean, I've mentioned recently, I mean, many people have observed how in schools, you know, we hear this cry for STEM. We have to have STEM, STEM, STEM. And where are the arts? Are children learning to play music? Are they learning to paint and sculpt and those kinds of things? And the answer is rhetorical.
Well, and look at just what you said. Look at what art has become. It used to be kind of like a presentation of beauty, and now it's a mm-hmm. montage of something that doesn't even make any sense and is supposed mm-hmm. to get you to be in your left brain, to think, to you know, not be part of nature and the world around us, but to be separate from and more important than nature. It gets worse and worse. I don't see how we're going to change that around, because we have nothing to rebel against. Like, maybe we'll get to this point of you know, where everything is so oppressive that we'll want to rebel. But you look around you and you don't see people doing that. You see people wearing their masks and doing the things that are socially acceptable and be part of the herd. and you know, they essentially are the lemmings that'll go over the cliff because, you know, that's what the herd is doing. It gets it's screwed. It's totally skewed.
Absolutely. Yeah, well said, as always.
Anyway, get on with the show. I truly enjoy the show.
Appreciate it, Richard. Much appreciated, as always.
Thank you.
There are little enclaves. You know, I've been thinking, speaking of that, of the Prohibition era, for example, and, you know, the backroom places that we read about and hear about and so forth. And with, you know, you come forward from that era through the Second World War in particular, and Jordan Peterson talking about in that interview with Jocko Willink, and the excerpt, how a totalitarian state is actually formed, which we play from time to time. And Jordan Peterson saying, you know, at the height of Nazi Germany, what was it? 1 in 3 people at every dinner table was a snitch. So, you know, how would that Prohibition era rebellion work in today's America, as that scientific dictatorship concept has advanced even further now? And of course, technology is ubiquitous in many ways, the spy technology. But there are enclaves where people are, I would say, behaving normally. You know, I talked about the VFW in Whitefish, you know, hearing a gentleman who worked there say, take that mask off. What are you doing? We don't do that here. And he was being, you know, he was being a little facetious, but the point was made. So, I don't know. Maybe it's possible. But I really do believe that it is incumbent upon people. It requires any sort of rebellion, requires coming to terms with the fact that, like Adams observed, you know, things... the possibility exists that what you're hearing is not actually being said, you know, for your best interest or by people who have your best interest at heart. And I think one of the best evidences of that is, you know, again, speaking of John Adams, he was the guy who observed that there is something very unnatural and odious in a government 1,000 leagues off. A whole government of our own choice. When was the last time we had that? A whole government of our own choice, managed by persons whom we love, revere, and can confide in, has charms in it for which men will fight. But there is something very unnatural and odious in a government 1,000 leagues off. When was the last time you shook the hand, even, of someone you voted for? When was the last time you sat down and had a conversation? When was the last town hall meeting where you had, there was a small group of folks? You know, when was the last time constituents had the, you know, undivided attention, you might say, of their elected officials? And I think it's been a while. And so how do these people that you've never met, how could they possibly have your best interests at heart, especially when you can see so many ideological differences in the planks of their platforms, for example? And especially now, when you see governors, for example, just running amok, I would say, drunk on power, trying to, again, justify their and legitimize their existence. It's a rhetorical question, but I really do think that Adams put it very aptly. There is something very unnatural and odious in a government 1,000 leagues off. And where are we today? So back to the phones. Mike in Kentucky, thanks for calling. Welcome.
I sometimes like to answer rhetorical questions, like there's one piece of prose that I ran across and it stuck in my head for a while was, be not overwise overmuch, why should thou destroy thyself? And I'm like, because the future we're headed toward ain't worth the hill of beans or something, you know? I mean, you could come up with an answer for that rhetorical question. But I, along the same lines, what you guys were talking about there, socially, it seems like a lot of people are conditioned to resent and shun people that are independent. I know here in Kentucky, we had a globalist interdependence, you know, float in our Independence Day parade in Lexington, Kentucky, in like 1998 or 99. Gatewood Galbraith laid down in front of that float. He's kind of a libertarian, I guess, pro-hemp guy. And it was a good piece of, you know, he made the news, got his name out. Most people vote for name recognition, so he's perpetually running for some office or another, mostly governor, but it ain't the last time he ran before he gave up. He was trying to run for attorney general, but he laid down in front of the parade and got charged with interfering with the procession, but it raised the awareness that, you know, independence, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, all that kind of stuff, they're trying to, you know, socially short-circuit that. And it seems like people that are attempting to be independent, well, you're one of them kooky preppers. I think they even made fun of Reba McEntire in the movie Tremors and her husband. They saved the town, you know, but they were preppers living in a concrete bunker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and did we lose Mike? I feel like we lost him. And self-reliant. We lost you, Mike. Feel free to call back. Yeah. And you can see the creeping encroachment in a variety of ways. One quick comment. I mentioned yesterday the House Judiciary Committee hearings featuring big tech CEOs. That was kind of interesting, but I didn't catch the end of it. It was a grilling, as some posited. Lawmakers grill Jeff Bezos, Tim Cook, Mark Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai. There were some interesting, but you know, what comes of all of that usually? And it always reminds me of British Parliament. It's theatrical in nature a lot of times. And so I don't know, maybe I'll go back and watch the end of that and see kind of where the, if we were all acquainted and familiar with and really understood the mechanics of this dialectical mechanism where, you know, you're constantly getting people to react, then we would stop reacting and we would just watch in sort of deadpan fashion and say, mm-hmm. So now, what are you proposing? Instead of being reactionary, it's a bad thing. You know, if you can get someone off balance, then you can defeat them, essentially, in, you know, martial arts terms, perhaps. Or in geopolitical terms, to destabilize is to, you know, is the pretext to reconstruction. And we've talked about that many times, you know. RL33627 is indelibly etched in my brain. Congressional Research Service Report, RL33627. NATO and Afghanistan, a test of the Transatlantic Alliance. The 2008 entry, in particular, I think it was October 2008. You know, talking about how NATO sought to create an organization beyond the European theater, and Afghanistan is a test of the alliance's military will, or political will and military capability. Just a test. It's a field exercise. And so it's nation building. You destabilize, then you stabilize and reconstruct, remake however you like. And that is the dialectical way in simple terms. So ordo ab chao sounds big. Wow, how could you? Well, this is how you do it, little by little, piece by piece. Remember, it was Richard N. Gardner, 1974, Hard Road to World Order, Foreign Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations Journal, quarterly periodical, where he said, an end run on sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, would be more successful than the old-fashioned frontal assault. That's how ordo ab chao is working. It's the evisceration and the constant erosion, the constant bombardment. And you just start stockpiling these menacing hobgoblins, and that's, you know, how it works. Mike, you're back?
I'm back. The other point I was trying to make, though, is that, you know, like with the American Revolution, that previous caller was talking about that. When a system of governance, or whatever you want to call it, oligarchical overlords, becomes so corrupted that people just don't want to contribute to it anymore, and you end up with something like the American Revolution, and they ultimately start to lose their taxing authority. Which
the guy who was predominantly responsible for the Declaration of Independence also mentioned that about once every generation we should have a significant check on power.
Also said a nation of independent farmers would be unconquerable, and what are they doing to us? They're trying to industrialize mm-hmm. agriculture at every turn, which is a big plank for Marxism.
Yep. You know, I honestly believe, speaking of those points, that you know some people have gone back. It's like these guys said these things, and they were supposed to be admonitions to us all, and these guys took that information out of the public sphere and then sort of reverse engineered it. What if we tried that? What if we tried to conquer farming? Oh, you know what? That works really well when we industrialize farming and there are no independent farmers. That worked really well. And then, you know, on down the list from there.
And I wanted to ask who that was you were referring to that came to our country, you know, where things weren't given to them. You get the other end of the spectrum where people escape from places like you know, Czechoslovakia, where they come in and just take all your stuff, or in the case Ukraine, they just starve you out, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's the other end of the spectrum too. People come to America and they really appreciate America because they came from a place where things could be far worse. And I think the Germans mm-hmm. said that you guys are tilting toward fascism. You don't realize what you're allowing to happen. We lived through it. Our grandparents lived through it. And we're not going to let it happen again, but you guys are headed right into it, full steam.
Yeah.
I'll let you go, I guess. Thanks. A storm, that may be what knocked my phone out. I don't want to be paranoid about getting cut off.
Yeah.
Bye.
Thanks, Mike. Much appreciated, as always. So hopefully it was informative, and hopefully we're making a difference for America, for ourselves, for our countrymen. And hopefully we can stave off the Borg, so to speak. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. Catch you on the other side.
After about a month of Extendivite, I don't know what it is about the circulation factor. I was able to increase the weight, increase the amount of sets I could do. It has to do with the oxygen getting to the blood. You should market this as an athletic performance. And I don't change anything about my diet or anything. I just thought, this is amazing. Bilberry extract has got something called resveratrol in it, which is the same stuff that you get from red wine. It's also good for eyesight, and I was reading that the Royal Air Force during World War II would give their pilots bilberry jam so they could have better night vision stuff. This is amazing.
To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.